Hello everyone and welcome to the Writers Book Club podcast. I'm Michelle Barraclough and each month I take a deep dive with an author into the writing craft and process behind one of their books. Now I know I said I was going to take a break from the podcast this month, but when one of your writing idols has some availability in her diary, you ditch the break happily. There was no way I was going to pass up the opportunity to chat with Charlotte Wood about the writing process for her latest novel, Stoneyard Devotional. Tim Winton said, "Charlotte Wood's Stoneyard Devotional is remarkable. I'm still trying to figure out how she pulled it off. The best thing she's done." Well, Tim, if you're listening, and I hope someone has pointed you to this episode, perhaps this deep dive into Stoneyard Devotional with Charlotte will go some way to helping you figure out how she did actually pull it off. I think everyone listening will get something out of this wonderful conversation. Charlotte is such a beautiful writer and a seasoned writer. You know, she's been there to all the places that you as a writer have been or are heading towards, and she shares that wisdom so generously. One of the things I love about Charlotte is her curiosity. She's constantly exploring and expanding upon her own creative process. And she draws inspiration and motivation from all areas of the arts, not just books and writing. The show notes for this episode are absolutely jam-packed with references to books and writers and films and artists, so make sure you check those out after you listen. Stoneyard Devotional is a stunning novel. Let me tell you what it's about. A woman abandons her city life and marriage to return to the place of her childhood, holing up in a small religious community hidden away on the stark plains of the Monero. She does not believe in God, doesn't know what prayer is, and finds herself living this strange, reclusive life, almost by accident. As she gradually adjusts to the rhythms of monastic life, she finds herself turning again and again to thoughts of her mother, whose early death she can't forget. Disquiet interrupts this secluded life with three visitations. First comes a terrible mouse plague, each day signalling a new battle against the rising infestation. Second is the return of the skeletal remains of a sister who left the community decades before to minister to deprived women in Thailand, then disappeared, presumed murdered. Finally, a troubling visitor to the monastery pulls the narrator further back into her past. With each of these disturbing arrivals, the woman faces some deep questions. Can a person be truly good? What is forgiveness? Is loss of hope a moral failure? And can the business of grief ever really be finished? All right, before we dive into the interview, let me tell you a bit about Charlotte Wood. She is the author of 7 novels and 3 books of nonfiction, including The Luminous Solution, which is her book of essays on the creative process, the international bestseller The Weekend, and The Natural Way of Things, which won a number of prizes, including the Stella Prize and the Prime Minister's Literary Award. Her new book, Stoneyard Devotional, was described by the UK Guardian as a quiet novel of immense power and has been praised by authors Anne Enright, Tim Winton, Karen Joy Fowler, Hannah Kent, and Paula Hawkins, among others. She recently launched Subtraction, a monthly newsletter on the creative process, and I've popped a link to that in the show notes, along with all of the other places you can find Charlotte. Please enjoy my chat with the wonderful Charlotte Wood. Charlotte, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for taking the time in what I know is a very busy period for you, right in the middle of festival season.
Thanks, Michelle. It's nice to be here. It is a busy time, but I'm in talking mode, so
yes.
Here we go.
Congratulations on this novel, Stoneyard Devotional. I absolutely loved it, and I'm not alone. Shortlisted for the ABIA Literary Fiction Book of the Year and the Age Book of the Year. Praise to the heavens in all the major press, both here and overseas. It must be exhilarating, but also a relief when these accolades roll in after so many months of having your head down in the work.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's nice to get those reviews, particularly that, you know, show you that you've hit the mark that you wanted to hit. I have been lucky with this one, especially the international ones that I've been really great. So, I mean, as for prizes, that's, you know,
yeah,
always a lottery, and I try to spend as little time as possible thinking about prizes, but the reviews are sort of lengthy responses, which are very nice.
Yes. When you see a review from Anne Enright, that must certainly be a lovely day when that lands in the inbox.
That was pretty exciting. I mean, I have to, you know, make clear it wasn't a review. She just said something very nice on Instagram, but it was unexpected and really lovely because she is really one of my absolute literary idols. So it was great. I was actually in, I got off a plane in Zurich and I was just getting onto one of those, you know, moving walkways, and I checked my Instagram, and when I realized who this was, I literally nearly fell off the walkway thing. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, because I don't think she goes by Anne Enright. It's something like the Wren Girl or something.
Yeah.
Something a little bit different.
Instagram, but yeah, lucky me.
Charlotte, I have so many questions. I can't wait to do a deep dive with you on the writing of this book. In your book on creativity, The Luminous Solution, you talk about the importance of heat seeking as a way of sensing and following the power or the energy coming from any part of the work. And I thought that would be a really good place to start. Where did the initial heat for this novel come from, and how did that then blossom into a full-blown concept for the novel?
Yes, well, it never becomes a full-blown concept until it's sort of almost done, really. It's more like little trail of breadcrumbs, you know, following one bit to another bit. But I actually can't remember why or how I started thinking about nuns, Catholic nuns, but I was sort of intrigued by the decision that some contemporary women make to join religious orders like that, because I could sort of understand. I mean, clearly for most people it's a matter of, you know, religious faith, but lots of people have religious faith and don't join a nunnery. And it particularly, I was interested in the withdrawal from normal society. So the order of nuns in my book is the community of nuns anyway, is a little cloistered order living out in the middle of the Monero Plains, which is where I grew up. So I had this sort of question of why would a woman roughly like me, say, join this kind of community? And only when I realized it was about the withdrawal from normal society, I thought, oh, I get that actually. I really understand that impulse. So that sort of gave me an interesting sort of tension in a way. If I was going to write about a woman somehow like me joining an order to live like that, there was already a tension in that, because this woman who is like me does not believe in God, and she doesn't have any religious belief and finds it all a bit weird and, you know, sort of silly at first. So that was already interesting to me, like that contradiction, I suppose, and contradictions are always helpful for me in writing fiction. So that was one thing I was sort of just letting percolate away. And then I happened to go on a trip back to the Monero, where I hadn't been for a long time. So the Monero Plains is an area of New South Wales, south of Canberra and north of the Snowy Mountains. And it's a very bare, stripped back kind of landscape. And I happened to go back there and realised that I wanted to write about that place, and particularly about my mother and my parents' deaths when I was a young person. And so, as is often the way, I had these two clouds of thought, I suppose, and I know now that for me, one way of doing this is to put these unrelated things together, and that is really helpful. So I often find that a way to start the kind of motor of something in a book is to bring unlike things together. And part of the heat generating process, I guess, is figuring out why those things belong together. How could they possibly go together? So I suppose that was the beginning of that process.
So how did the drafting process for Stoneyard Devotional proceed from there, Charlotte? What does it look like for you? I know that you very much go off social media and you go into your writing cave. Mm-hmm. That same process occur with Stoneyard Devotional?
I probably did. I need to do that again. The going off social media is actually becoming more and more of a kind of issue for me. This year I'm doing a lot of public speaking, so I kind of, it's good to be on it for that. But then to write, I need to be much quieter and more private. And yet this year, at least, if I wait till all the speaking's done, I won't get anything done for a year. So I'm trying to learn how to move more swiftly between it's the sort of public self and the private writing self, but that's a kind of aside. But, well, partly it was a strange book to write because a lot of it, I was writing it in lockdown, a lot of it. So, you know, everything had changed about the way all of us worked. It shouldn't have changed the way I worked because, you know, I was just here in my house. I don't have kids to homeschool. I didn't have people to look after, apart from my husband, who can look after himself.
And, I would hope.
And he was working, so he wasn't that affected by, just in the way we all were. But I was very, very anxious, though, through that pandemic period, and my concentration wasn't great. So I think some of the kind of tone of the book actually came out of the pandemic and that great, what I'd sort of call now the great chastening that took place or should have taken place about our human certainty about things, you know. But I was writing it in little fragments, and I just didn't want anything sort of extraneous in the book. So I was writing in little fragments, and I had fragments of things that were sort of to do with memories that I had about growing up in that area. I had imaginings about things in country towns. So some of the stuff in the book that is sort of the narrator's memories of the town when she was growing up, some of those are what I think are memories of mine. Some of them are imaginings. Some of them are things that I heard about, you know, something in another town or place. But this very fragmented way of working, I guess I always work in that way anyway, but usually in kind of fully formed scenes, but this was much more fragmented. And I guess, you know, looking back, I think some of that probably came out of my fragmented attention at the time. And then it was a matter of, so I'd write fragments about the narrator and her mother. I'd write fragments about the narrator entering this community of Catholic nuns and the things that she observes and sees there. And then I had to sort of work out what was the relationship between these things. And so there's a character called Helen Parry, who is a kind of radical activist nun who turns up in the story. And that was useful to me because of her way of living an ethical life is the complete opposite of the way of these women who live there. So she's out in the world, she's fighting, she's making noise, she's sort of standing up, speaking truth to power, agitating, acting. Whereas these other women, their ethical way of being in the world is to be very still and silent and withdraw and retreat. So there was a kind of culture clash there that was interesting to me. An example of this putting things together and making sense of them, I had a scene that the narrator remembered about a schoolgirl being sort of attacked in her school as a child. And I was also writing this other stuff about Helen Parry. And not for a very long time did I realise or make those two people be the same person. So once I, and those are the kind of connections that only come for me very slowly after a long period of just having faith that there is a connection between things. And eventually, you know, I sometimes sit back and go, well, what's going on here? Why is Helen Parry even there really? I mean, there's a reason that she goes there to return the bones of this other nun who's disappeared many decades before. But, you know, why there? Why did she go there? Why is it not somebody else? And then, so then it sort of came to me, well, she's from there. And then I could use, oh, there's this girl already waiting there in the, you know, in the draft. So maybe that's her. So things like that are just connections that I really have to wait and wait for and have faith that there is a deeper logic going on in the back of my brain that my sort of conscious brain doesn't really understand for some time.
Delicious reveal in the book. It must have been lovely when that connection happened for you in the writing as well. Charlotte, the way you talked about the fragments and the way this novel is structured, is it's my favourite kind of structure to read, those detail-rich fragments, those vignettes flowing seamlessly between the past and the present and told in a really intimate first-person voice as though we're reading this woman's journal, and we are.
Mm.
Did you have an idea for how the novel would be structured before you started writing? I'm thinking not, but how did that evolve, this sort of journal idea and what have you?
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I never organised anything before. I don't seem to be able to, really. So it's a process of discovering, you know,
yeah.
And it's an instinct that, and it's, you know, it's hard to talk about this in any useful way for a new writer because you can say, oh, it's instinct and, you know, what is that? That doesn't help anybody. But I think what you learn as you go along as a writer and you get more experience is how to recognise a good instinct and then to trust it, you know, and just keep going into all this uncertainty and this, you know, with sort of blind faith, really. So I had the kind of journal entries. I was reading a few diaries at the time. I was reading Helen Garner's diaries, and I love that very fragmented, just those tiny little shreds of observations that she makes. You know, the placement of them next to each other makes a story. So I guess that was part of it. And I had the first bit where it's very sort of overtly a diary. She says day one, day two, day three. And it's about her entering this weird place where she's only going temporarily for a sort of little bit of respite. So then, and for a long time, then I kept up that very explicit diary form through the rest of the book. And in the editing process, in the drafting process, was a matter of then removing the explicitness of it and just having it. So initially it is her writing her diary, and then there's a, you know, she stays there for 4 days and then she leaves thinking, this is all pretty weird. Anyway, I'm going back to my normal life. And then we turn the page and several years have gone by and she's now living in this place. So I quite liked that little, I don't know what it is, well, the narrative gap, I suppose, doing some narrative propulsion as well. Then I liked the way it just sort of becomes an almost internal diary. You know, we don't know if she's actually writing it down or not after a while, and it seems that she probably isn't, but it's still got that form of a very internal voice. And it's a story of great stillness and a lot of silence, which is rather tricky in a novel, you know, because you don't really want stillness and silence in a novel. You need things to happen, or at least, I mean, I don't really care about things happening in books as a reader. All I want is to be compelled to read on. And quite often for me, that's a matter of voice rather than anything. But I still needed, I mean, interesting things happen when stasis is interrupted. So I did then bring in some interruptions of, you know, the mouse plague comes into this book. I mean, it's pretty visceral. And then the return of these, you know, Helen Parry and the bones of the other nun.
I love that concept of breaking the stasis, and you do that so well. This is not a book that stays still in that sense. There's always something happening internally. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not until you finish reading. I've read it a couple of times now, and it was only on the second reading that I realized there's not much dialogue in here, but you don't need it or want it or miss it when it's not there.
Yeah, I wanted to. I had a kind of little challenge for myself of writing a book that had only the what I considered to be the absolute essential things in there. And, you know, it is a very narrow kind of portrait, I suppose. It's through one woman's eyes. There's stuff she doesn't know. There are things that she never finds out that are questions that she has. But I had to sort of just trust that the tone of the book, the place of the book, and the events that do happen all worked together, like very hopefully seamlessly braided, so that it feels natural and whole.
I know that you've said a few times in different interviews that you didn't want to explain too much or hold the reader's hand in this novel. What drove that decision, and how did that work in terms of putting the words on the page, or was that predominantly in the writing or then in the editing, just stripping back?
It was both. I did start out with that feeling of I wanted to write something that felt very bare bones to me for some reason. And I came across a W.B. Yeats quote very early on in the writing, and it might have even been before I started writing this book, and I was very taken by it, and I kind of kept going to it as my sort of little guide as I wrote. And that was a remark that he made in an essay, The Cutting of an Agate, and he said, only that which does not teach, which does not cry out, which does not condescend, and which does not explain is irresistible. And I think I just really sort of lifted towards that because I'd felt, I don't know, sometimes in reading contemporary literature that, I don't know, things were getting a bit finger waggy or sort of teacherly, or and that I had done it myself as well. You know, I felt like, I guess, being a little too heavy handed with thematic ideas or, you know, messages. And I was just really sick of reading books with messages in them, and I just didn't want to write them. And, you know, I'd always tried not to, but I don't think I'd fully succeeded in that. And also, as a reader, I want to do the work, you know, in terms of making meaning out of spaces and putting things together that are not explicitly linked by the author. And I was reading a lot of those little fragmented books like Deborah Levy's trilogy, The Cost of Living and Real Estate, and I think Things I Don't Want to Know was the first one. Elizabeth Strout's Lucy Barton books. And I remember the first time I read My Name is Lucy Barton years ago, I was sort of confused by it. I kept thinking, I don't get this. I don't understand. I'd read Olive Kitteridge and absolutely adored it, but I couldn't really grasp onto what she was doing with the Lucy Barton book. But I knew enough to know it was me, not her, you know. So I just thought, I'll come back to this some other time because I need to understand it. Anyway, and then I did go back to it some other time and I just absolutely loved it. And it was obviously for me at the right time. And, I mean, that's something that it's hard to, well, I try not to think about it as a writer, that a book will only work for a reader if they read it at the right time, especially a book that is, that has had a lot of gaps and a lot of space. But, you know, I wanted to write a book like that. That felt like that to me. So that was a kind of stylistic aim from early on, but it also had to be the right material, you know, for that aim to fit. And things have to kind of go together. So it seemed to me that it did go together, this one.
It's funny you mentioned Elizabeth Strout because, well, when I first read your novel, I gobbled it up because it was a Charlotte Wood and I just sort of grabbed it and gobbled it all up in one greedy go. And then reading it the second time around, and I had just reread My Name is Lucy Barton for something else, and I'd read O. William when it came out, and I just went, oh, it's this Strout-esque.
I love her work and I'm very influenced by that, so I'm very flattered if you felt that.
Can I read you one of the sections that came out to me? It's just a sentence. There were many things about my mother's life, her secret self, that remained hidden from me, and this was one of those things. That just sounded Strout-esque to me.
Well, you know, you absorb the writers that you love. And
yeah, I want to talk to you about that later.
When I was first writing, I used to get very anxious about that. And a lot of new writers do go, oh, but what if I'm unconsciously, you know, plagiarising? I'm like, well, it's really not plagiarism if you're absorbing the rhythms of another writer and the kind of tone or voice or something. I mean, other people might disagree, but that's not something I'm at all concerned about.
So you talked about new writers, and I feel like, you know, you're Charlotte Wood and you've written books on writing and you've written all these novels, and I, as a reader, completely trust you to take me where I'm going. But for a new writer, paring back this language and making the reader work, and it can be risky, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's hard to, well, there are a few things at play there that make one into a kind of over-explainer as a writer, and I have been that writer. And one of those things is a kind of worry that people won't know what you mean. And that was a worry that I just completely let go of with this one. And I do think this is my 10th book, and I feel that it's taken me this long to have not just the kind of, I mean, courage is a kind of very silly word, but...
But we talk about fear in writing, so perhaps courage is the right word.
Yeah, it's a fear of being misunderstood or of not being helpful to a reader. And I think that is really something really key that would be good for all of us to get rid of, this idea that I have to have the reader understand exactly what I mean. And that could mean not just sort of being sort of too verbose or something, but also over-explaining. It's a sort of controlling impulse for me that I wanted to get rid of myself of. So it might be like really describing something with such detail and so much detail that the reader can't possibly, you know, so I'm holding up my phone cover here. If I was to describe that exactly, the dimensions and the colour and the shape and the texture and, you know, so that the reader could only have this picture of this phone cover in their mind, I don't know, I'm just sort of sick of that. It's like, why do I need them to know exactly that? I mean, some things I do want them to know exactly what I mean, but I just relaxed a lot more with this, I guess, and thought, well, it doesn't matter. I can just say phone cover and it doesn't matter what, you know, what it looks like in their head. And, in fact, that's part of the pleasure of reading is making your own. I mean, a phone cover is such a boring thing to use as an example, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, yeah.
But I think there's also a kind of pleasing the reader impulse that has grown up partly, well, I mean, we, you know, you do want to please the reader, of course. But for me anyway, I think, you know, the rise of social media and of things like Goodreads and, you know, all this sort of feedback from readers to writers is, it's kind of dangerous in a way. Well, it's dangerous to pay any attention to it because you get into a sort of almost like a customer service mentality. And you certainly do have readers who say, well, I didn't like this because these people were nothing like my friends and blah, blah, blah. And it's almost the tone of their saying this to you, like directly sometimes, is like, I read your book and it didn't please me. And, you know, it takes a while for you, for I think maybe especially female writers, to go, oh, well, tough shit, you know. You can read another book. But also I think there's, in new writers, there's also a fear of editors who will say, well, it's not quite clear what's going on here. And I think it takes you a while to develop your own sense of how much clarity is what you intend, you know. And sometimes, you know, when I went through the editing process with the wonderful Ali Laveau, who's been my editor for a long time now, there were a couple of things she said, look, I'm with you on the no explaining. I'm totally on board. But very occasionally, it's so opaque that you actually draw more attention to it. So there's early on in the novel, we understand that the narrator's been married and is no longer, or, you know, the marriage has ended. And I had nothing about that in the draft that went to the editor. And Ali said, well, it just makes my mind snag on that all the time instead of just putting something really brief in there that I can go, ah, okay, and then move on. Not a big long detail, not a big backstory, not a big explanation, but just something, you know. So I guess I also am lucky that I have a relationship with an editor and a publisher that I trust to say, okay, you can go that far, but at this point is too much in that direction. And I believe them. And that's a luxury, you know, that's comes out of 10 books and a long publishing career with the same people often.
Charlotte, this isn't your first rodeo when it comes to leaving space for the reader in your novels. I think I read the last couple of chapters of The Natural Way of Things 3 times before it actually dawned on me that there were no overt clues as to what happened to the girls.
Yeah.
And to Verla. And it was up to me to interpret it as I wanted to. But then I had this delicious pleasure of combing through those pages again, looking for all the reasons to support my own hypothesis, a sort of a literary choose your own adventure, if you will. Do you think some of the seeds for not holding the reader's hands were sown then?
Well, I think I've always aspired to do that, but I've a lot of the time been too anxious to really do it. But certainly the ending of that book, yeah, was really, I wanted it to be open-ended in that. And lots of people said to me afterwards, you know, so what did happen?
Yeah.
Where
we're so
where
invested.
And I was like, you know as much as I know, you know. And I don't, I mean, it's tricky because I didn't want to do it in a glib sort of ha-ha way, you know, not in a kind of you're expecting something and I'm deliberately going to smash that expectation as a kind of trick. I don't, and I hope it doesn't read like that, but it's
definitely doesn't read like that at
and
all.
And it's, I mean, it's about the question of how women enter into or not their own oppression, right? So, and how much courage are we prepared to have as women? So, you know, it seemed to work for me, but again, it's that thing where you just have to trust your own instinct on that front. And you can certainly, you know, manipulate it or tweak it. But if you have a very strong gut feeling, and this is this thing about heat that I'm always talking about, but if your gut feeling is I need this in my book, then I think it's really important to stick with it, even if you do have editorial advice against it. I had a question at the Newcastle Writers Festival recently for a woman who said she published a short story and there'd been something in it that was very important to her, but the editor said, look, it just doesn't work, take it out. And she'd felt she couldn't really articulate why she really wanted to keep it, but she sort of, you know, respected the editor and did what she was told, and the story was published and all that, and it was fine. But she said, I still kind of wish I didn't let it go. And my answer to that was, well, I think it's good, A, to listen to editors, because especially when you're a new writer, they do know stuff and they can teach you. But also, if that was really important to you, hang on to it, but figure out why, you know, not and figure out what the problem that the editor was pointing to may have had a different solution than taking that bit out. Maybe it was like, actually go further into it, make it more explicit or bigger, or, you know. So I don't discount other people's opinions in the editing process ever, but I try and address them in a way that is true to what I want in the book as well. Yeah.
And to the story that you're trying to tell. Charlotte, this is the first time you've written in first person since your first novel, Pieces of a Girl. How was that? How did you sort of handle those limitations of writing in first person?
Well, again, it was sort of a matter of just wanting to do something different. And you're right, I did it in my first book a gazillion years ago, and then I sort of ran away from it in some, I don't know why, I think I got some idea that it was kind of babyish or something to write in first person. Anyway, and also it is technically much harder, because especially if it's first person present tense, which a lot of this book is, it can become quite claustrophobic if you've got no other point of view and no kind of sense of time moving, or, you know, no temporal variety, I suppose. In this book, I did have that.
You do have that.
Yeah. But I do have these sort of elements of the narrator's past. And I think I was just able to handle it better narratively, because I'd built up, you know, ways of creating narrative tension since, you know, I wrote my first book. But it was, I suppose it was a deliberate decision to not to try and hide, because a lot of the book is very personal to me, and it's very, you know, the relationship that the narrator has with her mother is very definitely my relationship with my mother, even though it's a kind of slant portrait of my mother, because a whole lot of real detail about my mother, like the fact that she had four other children than me, is not in the book. So, you know, necessarily then that's a very skewed portrait of a mother of one child than the mother of five children. And lots of other things. I know that there'd be friends of my mother's looking at that book going, this is not her at all, you know, and that's fine. That doesn't bother me. That's why it's fiction. But I was ready to, I guess, to be less protective of the real details of my life in my fiction. I didn't need to transform them as much as I have done in other books, or hide them, or make sure nobody would think it was about me. You know, I sort of don't care now. And so it's sort of about me, and yet I have not gone and left my husband and joined a nunnery. You know, there is a whole lot of things that are most definitely not about me. And there are characters like Helen Parry's totally invented, and Richard Gittins totally, you know, all the people in the kind of present day of the story are completely invented. And, yeah, and a lot of the memory stuff is completely transformed. So it is, you know, it ends up being a kind of fully fictional work, but I suppose I was just ready to, it was part of that thing of not wanting any artifice, even though, you know, I'm contradicting that by saying that most of it's invented, but I wanted a feeling that this is all true, you know. And I had a nice email from a writer friend, a man who I know really well, and he said, like, I knew you hadn't ever lived in a monastery, but I kept feeling like you did, you know. And that to me was a great compliment, because I suppose he could recognize the true-ish things about my voice or whatever, that they were put together with all those utterly invented things.
You talked about just then you could be true, and I loved how if the narrator didn't know something, she could state that plainly. There's an example here. So a man that comes to help the women and at the, we're calling it a nunnery, Charlotte, or a monastery?
Well, they call it a monastery.
Monastery. Richard Gittins, she went to school with, and he's doing some work on the farm, and he picks her up in his Land Cruiser while she's out on a run. And she says, I got into his passenger seat, and as I buckled my seatbelt, I told him my name and said we'd been at high school together. He frowned, confused for a moment, then broke into a smile of recognition. Ha, yes, we were, he said. And then as he drove along the pale road in the early sunlight, the flat golden plains spreading out on either side of us, he said, Meaning, I think, that he would not have expected to see me back here, but I liked that he didn't ask me any questions about it. And since that day, I've thought of Richard as my friend, though I have no idea if he feels the same way. And I loved that because, you know, we talk about limitations of first person and that desire to over-explain, but here she's just said, you know, I liked that he didn't ask me any questions. I don't know what he really thought, stating it plainly.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know, it just seemed to, that sort of stuff seemed to come quite easily with this book, that I suppose because, again, it's about the match of the material and the tone and the voice, in that she's come to this place, which is largely a place of silence, and things are not answered, and it, and the pace is very slow and kind of rhythmic, and Richard Gittins goes and helps these women, you know, like if they need a heavy job done in the garden or et cetera, like helping with the chook shed or whatever. And I suppose he only is happy to do that because he's happy not to ask a lot of questions, and he's not a chatty kind of person, and, you know.
That also gives us an insight into how she chooses to interpret things. And in this case, it's sort of in a positive, benevolent way, because her thoughts aren't always kind, like many of us have thoughts. And she sometimes berates herself for being a bit judgy or mean, you know, when she's talking about Carmel's ghastly little back scratcher or Dolores driving her absolutely mad with her operatic sneezing, which I had to laugh at. And I just thought that gave us a beautiful insight, also a reflection of the kind of person that her mother was. So, yeah, it was just a beautiful piece.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it was sort of pleasurable to just look at the tiniest domestic things,
yeah,
and put them in the book, you know, in a way that in another book it'd be just like, what the hell is that? You know, who cares? But because in this place everything is slowed down, and also I suppose her big problem in this monastery is her own ego, you know, and learning to live with these people who, you know, she really respects Simone, the kind of boss nun, and she really likes her and thinks she's very smart and kind of rigorous. And Bonaventure, one of the other older ones, and she really likes her too. But the younger ones drive her nuts. She just thinks they're silly little girls who talk about Jesus as if he's their boyfriend, you know. But she knows that this tendency of hers to pass judgment on these younger women, she's there to kind of eradicate that from herself. Like she tries to believe in God. She tries to pray. Like she has enough respect for them and their way of life that she wants to understand what all of this means. So it's kind of an experiment for her. But she's still human, and she's still, you know, pretty, feels quite superior to lots of them, and also is deeply conflicted about being in this place that is sort of ostensibly a part of the Catholic Church, when she has such, you know, as I think any thinking person does, even if they are in the Catholic Church, they know that there are some terrible damage has been done by some parts of the Catholic Church. So, you know, that's another tension in her, is how can I justify being here? But, and yet, and that phrase, and yet, she quotes a Jewish writer, Elie Wiesel, who says, and yet, are basically the two most important words. That phrase is really important because it's about always seeing another view, not just your own.
Two things can be true.
That's right, at the same time.
I'm guessing that this idea of specificity that you've talked about and George Saunders talks about and other writers had an important role in this stripping back of the language and the novel. That's really evident in your descriptions in particular. Is specificity something that is really important to you in your writing?
Yes, because it's sort of the only way to make something feel true, I think. And I keep quoting this as if that's from Chekhov. I don't even know if it is Chekhov, but I think it was Chekhov who said, only in the particular can be found the universal. Because if you're not really specific in your description of something, then it's just an outline. You know, it's a sort of, I mean, I guess I'm also contradicting what I said earlier about letting the reader, you know, do the work of what colour the table is or whatever. And yet if it's something important, I do want to be extremely precise and specific, because I think it brings a feeling of truth to the words, even if they are completely invented. And it just does a lot of work for you, being really specific.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't contradict it. It enhances what you're saying, because by being specific, you're able to strip away a lot of the extraneous descriptions and things like that just by really...
Yes, and it's the telling detail.
Yeah.
So it's not all of the detail, but one particular bit of whatever it is. It might be a landscape, or it might be a feeling, an emotion, you know. Or I just think it's just more interesting when you can really pinpoint something, particularly if it's in human behaviour, you know. So it's not just like an outline of a mannequin walking around. It's a real human being.
You were talking about Helen Garner before. She does that so well.
Mm.
But so do you. I want to just give the listeners an example of this. It's on page 7. Anita, the housekeeper, chatty and broad-bummed, shivering a little in her maroon fleece vest over a turquoise shirt, navy pants. She leads me around the buildings and grounds, and I trot behind her as she rattles on. She could never be a nun. Imagine getting up for vigils at 5 a.m. in winter. Plus, they can't watch Netflix. That's never going to work for me. That's just a paragraph. Like, it's literally 6 lines, and it says everything you need to know about Anita.
I'm glad. Thank you. Yeah, it's sort of, I mean, that kind of thing of people's vocal tics is really helpful to try and remember or note down when it, you know, if you go to the pharmacist or whatever. That I find that really helpful to kind of create character, this sort of vocal delivery. I mean, Anita is a super minor character, but, and in a way, they're almost the most important ones to have a kind of really specific image of, because the major characters, you can be quite blurry for quite a long time, you know, and you gradually build up a picture of them. But if they're just coming through a scene, then you need them to be, you know, as sharp as possible.
And it's right throughout. I mean, people are going to have to read the book if they want all the gory descriptions of the mouse plague, but they are some of the best, absolutely. As you say before, visceral descriptions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the mouse plague is interesting because there's a lot of, questions me, what do the mice mean? And I had questions for myself all the way through. What do the mice mean? Why have I got a plague in there? And in the end, I decided to just not answer it because I don't know. And yet people have told me what they think it means, and it's been amazing to me and really quite beautiful and really deeply thought ideas, and I think they're all right, you know. Yep. But the reason that I put a mouse plague in there was that there was a mouse plague going on, you know, while we were in the middle of COVID and floods and after the bushfires, there was a mouse plague in the west of New South Wales at least. And a friend of mine was living on her farm and told me one day that she said, oh, God, last night we were all asleep and then suddenly in the middle of the night we heard the piano playing. And I just found that so – and it was the mice inside the piano. And but I just found that image of it so chilling and sort of like deliciously creepy and scary. And it was almost like, well, I can't just – leave that there, you know. Someone's got to do something with that incredible image. So I put it in my book, and then it was like, well, I guess I have to have a mouse plague now, you know. And then it became very useful narratively, actually, because it sort of, you know, creates a whole lot of tension. It's this thing that grows and swells and sort of threatens and is menacing, and that was very useful to have that sort of tide of threat coming into this very serene sort of place.
Even though this is a quiet contemplative novel in many ways, it still has stakes and conflict and action and all the things that make you want to keep turning the page. And the mouse plague is one of those things. Helen Parry is one of those things. I remember you talking about, and you were talking about a novel in progress, which was, I think, what turned out to be The Weeknd. And you said you just had this terrible day and it wasn't working, and you went inside to your husband and said, it's not working, I have to give it up, it's just not working. And then you sat with that idea for a while, and then it came to you that it needed action, your characters actually needed to go and do something. And that's always stuck in my mind when I've been stuck in my writing, is like, go make something happen.
Yes, and it was sort of, I remember that day very clearly, and I've just written about it actually. I've just started a newsletter about the creative process, and I described that day, and that particular issue was of the newsletter was about comparison and envy and stuff, and how, you know, comparison is really destructive, but it can be really helpful if you do it in the right way. And that day I was writing this very dead scene. It was just, as you said, nothing was happening. I mean, it was dead on the page. And next to me, I had one of Ayn Enright's books, which I always have around. I've just got one right here in front of me. And I just picked up her book and read a scene at random. And it's like, it was so good. And mine was so bad. And I, you know, just literally thought, well, what's the difference then? What's the difference between hers and mine in this paragraph? And what became really clear was that hers had much more layers and it was not static. I had a woman sitting around thinking about herself. She had a woman not sitting around, like doing something while thinking about herself, while thinking about other people, while hearing something from outside, while so layers and layers of movement. So it was all about movement, and mine was just too still. So then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to put some movement and contradiction and interruption into this very static scene of mine, and then I could sort of rescue it a bit. And it was very helpful to go, right, well, just read something good and figure out what the difference is. It seemed quite, you know, simple, really.
Was that the weekend that you were
Yeah,
working
it
on?
was the weekend. It was
Yeah.
the weekend, and it was a scene where I had Adele, I think, sitting on the train going to the place. So she was sort of moving, but she was just sitting. Whereas I think when I rewrote that, I can't remember now if it stayed in the book or got chucked out or whatever, but I had, okay, she's sitting on a train, she's sitting next to someone and that person is moving. And then something else she sees out of the window and that, and then her phone rings and then she has to. So there's this kind of things were interrupting this very static scene, and they were physical things outside of her head. You know, they were things to do with the outside world
Yeah.
moving around her.
Which you've brought into this novel as well, which could have been, a woman goes to a monastery and thinks about her life. Let's throw in a mouse plague. Let's throw in the return of this childhood friend, not a friend really, a girl she knew from school who'd been badly bullied and some incidents had happened there. Let's bring in the bones of Sister Jenny, even the flash, I don't want to call them flashbacks because
I
they're,
know it's funny, isn't it? Because I
yeah,
hate
I
backstory
know.
and flashback, but they are certainly
Her
fragments of her earlier life, her
memory
memory.
fragments.
Yeah.
Let's go with that. Something's happening in them. Things are happening in them. So I'm wondering if that's the sort of lesson from the weekend that you've brought into this novel. You feel like you learn
Yeah.
from each novel? Some
Well, I wish I felt like that because you kind of, I mean, I think you do incrementally, you sort of build up a kind of, I don't know, good compost, shall we say, of method and helpful ways of doing things. But it never feels when you're starting a new book that you really know how to do it consciously. Like I'm starting one now and it's like, ugh, sort of, I'm still in the treading water. But what I know now is that this is how it is. Just go with it. Don't think, oh, this means it isn't working, which I, you know, for the first four books or whatever would have thought that. It's just a phase that you have to get through to find out what's going to happen. But
Yeah.
also I think the more you go on, the better you are at diagnosing problems before or foreseeing why going down that path is not a good idea, because if I do that, this and that will be a problem. Unless
Yeah.
it's one of those real gut things that you just need for no good reason to have in there. And then I just trust that.
Yeah. Which comes back to trust again, trusting the reader, trusting yourself, trusting the process. You've mentioned that a few times, and I think it's just, this is my fourth season of doing this podcast, and its concept that comes up a lot is trust. And I think that's one of the things new writers find hardest about
Yeah.
writing is trusting the process.
Because we're all control freaks, right? You want to
Oh.
make sure that it's going to work.
Yeah.
And the thing about making art is, you know, it's quite important not to know if it's going to work, I think. I mean, at a certain point, you do, but energy comes from risk. And the risk that this is not actually going to come together can help energize a book. So I think just getting used to that not knowing, that sort of toleration of uncertainty, which is the entire life of an artist, is living with uncertainty on every single level, you know, economically, whether you're even going to get published, whether anyone's going to read it if you do, whether the book will work. If you can't tolerate that as an absolute, you know, working state, then you're just not going to be able to write for any length of time, because you just go crazy trying to control things and trying to predict outcomes there. Because if you do that, if you do control it too tightly so that you can predict outcomes, you often get really quite dull work as a result. So being open to the uncertainty also means being open to surprise and things that come to you in a dream, or, you know, I don't want to sound romantic about it, but I, for me, as I've gone on, I feel that my work has gotten better because I have become better at allowing that unconscious part of my brain to come to the fore as much as possible.
Talk to me about voice, Charlotte. How did the voice come for this novel come to you very easily?
It did feel that it did. I had a period of sort of taking stuff away quite early on that just felt, I think I was writing sort of before the pandemic hit, and then I had some of these kind of little sort of slightly comic elements. And then when the pandemic happened, I was just like, that's just stupid. You know, the kind of trivial things just fell away really easily because nothing felt trivial anymore. Everything felt so serious and tender and, you know, elemental in a way. Then the voice kind of, my dedication to a very stripped back voice just grew and grew. And I just, by the end, it was like I was just peeling back anything that felt too unnecessary or trivial or sort of silly or that was straining for attention. I just wanted it to be as bare as possible and then just trust that it would work. And whether it would work or not, I still wanted it to be like that.
And having that journal format, at least in part one, helped that along. I felt you could get a really good sense of her voice in that first, on day one, you know, arrive finally at about 3. It's not, I arrived at around 3 p.m.
Yes. And I really rewrote that very sentence or group of sentences a lot of times, trying that I arrive at about 3 o'clock. No, I arrive at 3. No, arrive, because I wanted that sense of it's a diary to herself. No one else is reading this, you know, in her mind. So it's just like a kind of note-taking voice where she doesn't need to say I, because of course it's I. And it's the same reason she doesn't have a name, because she wouldn't, she's only writing this in either in on paper or in her head, where she doesn't need to name herself to herself, you know.
Yeah.
So that sort of guiding principle of nothing unnecessary was quite helpful in getting the voice as sort of, I did find that came fairly easily once I had that commitment to nothing extraneous.
And that's, we're pointing at the screen, is sort of that honing in, isn't it, on the voice.
Yeah.
I remember, and I think this was you, Charlotte, but correct me if I'm wrong, I remember you once talking about how there'll be a sentence or a phrase in the novel that you're working on that becomes your go-to for tone.
Like tuning fork sort of.
Yes.
Thing.
Was that you?
Yeah. It was me. I think, I'm sure lots of people have said it, but I do find that, I think I read something by David Malouf once talking about what he called a touchstone sentence. Mm. Every book has a touchstone sentence. And I am now not sure whether he meant within the book that you are writing or somebody else's sentence, and I do both of those things.
Yes, doesn't matter.
You know, I will go, so I do, I have a pile of books, and actually I've got a little, this shelf down here, I don't know if you can see it, these are my, I just wrote a little label on that shelf, instruction manuals, and they're not, you know, they're novels, but they have something of what I want tonally. And so reading, and actually in Kate Grenville and Sue Wolfe's book Making Stories, Kate Grenville has a really great, great explanation of voice and of getting the voice for her book Lillian's Story. And she said it was to do with, what she was reading at the time, which was a lot of Jane Austen and Shakespeare. And she said it wasn't, she said, I would just open them and sort of refresh myself at them and then sit down and write. And it wasn't that I was writing in any way like those voices, but somehow reading them put her into the space of the voice that she wanted. And I found that incredibly helpful when I read that, you know, 30 years ago or something. And I do that. That's what those books are there for, and the Anne Enrights and the, you know, Strouds.
Can I ask which Anne Enright you have on the, oh, the Wren?
Yeah. But I've also got, so I've got Elizabeth Strout there. I've got Joan London. Joan Silber is another one I love. So they're just something about their tone and their way of seeing the world. Helen Garner would go in there as well.
Yeah, I've got a Helen Garner in. I've got a pile like yours. It just sits at the back of my desk here, and it's just, I can even just look at them now and just know from looking that that's the tone I
it's
want.
It's interesting, isn't it? It does something to your unconscious maybe that reminds you, yes, that's where I'm going somehow, tonally.
You talk about it in The Luminous Solution. It's one of those concepts that you talk about as embodying or impersonating, which you say is the deliberate imaginative borrowing of another's perspective as a useful creative tool.
Yeah, the impersonation thing is, it's helpful not just to use writers for that purpose, but I often think of other artists.
Yes.
And in The Luminous Solution, I described when I was writing The Natural Way of Things, and I was constantly getting so anxious about what I was doing, writing this horrible, you know, brutal book about misogyny and why and what did it mean and all this sort of tedious sort of second guessing. And then something that really helped me was coming across the work of Louise Bourgeois, the surrealist sort of sculptor and artist, whose exhibition just finished in Sydney. Is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. But when I came across her work, which had all these weird sort of feminine symbols all through it, but with no explicit meaning being just, you know, explained. That's what I love about visual art. Nobody, you look at a painting and there's no one saying, this chair is here because, you know, it represents blah, blah. It's just a chair in the picture. Yeah. And Louise Bourgeois' ones were like weird, creepy, like uteruses hanging in a cage and then a dress and then, you know, a spider. And you go, okay, I don't know what that means, but it's making me feel something very deep and visceral and powerful. So whenever I got worried in writing The Natural Way of Things, I'd think, no, I'm Louise Bourgeois. I'm going to just have the guts that she had to just put it down and step back from it, you know, and go, well, there it is. I don't know what it means, but it's got some sort of power that I don't have to know what it means. And I think that's another anxiety that new writers have a lot, and I still have it, but I'm trying to rid myself of it. Just go with it. Put it down, because if it's right, nobody will question you about it. You know, there's a scene in Stone Yard Devotional, and I've been really surprised at how many people have brought it up at, you know, readings and things I've done with in bookshops and stuff. And it's a really brief scene where the narrator recalls making a bed, and she had all this stuff on the bed, and she lifted the sheet and all the crap fell off onto the floor. And as the sheet came down and made this clear space, she said something like, as I watched that, I knew what I wanted, and it took me a long time to get it. Now, that it doesn't really make any sense to have this little fragment of making a bed in the middle of this story, but again, I just trusted whatever that instinct was that told me to put it there, and it's been really weird to me how many people have raised it as something they really remember of the book. When she made the bed, it's like, wow.
I remember that because it was the description of the sheet billowing up and then softly.
Yes, yes. And the air inside.
Yes, we've all had that feeling.
So I guess it's something about recognition. And so that's where the metaphor or whatever it was landed enough with enough people. But if I tried to rationalize why I should put that scene in, and particularly where it was, and, you know, you can't really rationalize something like that. So, and if you do rationalize it, it destroys it.
Yeah.
So you just have to be prepared to go, well, my brain told me to put it there, I'm putting it there.
Again, the trust.
Yeah, absolutely.
In her post, Anne Enright said that in this novel you'd achieved, and I quote, technically one of the best time shifts I've read in years between sections 1 and 2. No lie, I gasped. First of all, making Anne Enright gasp, you know, that's an achievement in itself.
I'll die happy knowing that.
And then that reminded me of, I'm not going to read it because I think people need to read that and get the gasp themselves. But it reminded me of a conversation that you had with Joan Silver on your podcast, The Writer's Room, where you talked about scene versus summary. And that time shift is sort of the ultimate example of summary and the way you handled it. Can you talk about this idea of scene versus summary? Because I remember when you were talking to Joan, this is something that was in your mind at the time.
It was, because she wrote a fantastic essay called Weight in Fiction, as in W-E-I-G-H-T, in fiction, and how do you know when something has weight and sort of substance as opposed to not. Maybe it was in her book about time, actually. It was. She's got a little tiny book called Time, The Art of Time in Fiction. So I am still a little hazy on what it means, but what I found interesting was, if you learn writing in creative writing classes or, you know, workshops and stuff, as many of us do and did, there has been in the last, I don't know, 50 years probably, this kind of obsession with show, don't tell. And that, you know, if you tell something, that's wrong and you must show it in a scene. And I sort of, you know, obediently did that for a long time. And then I just think it's much more interesting if you can sometimes just say things rather than show them, you know. And again, you know, it's just got to work well enough. But it's also kind of a more adult way of understanding literature, all the different possibilities of literature. You don't have to just do one kind of approach. And so I hadn't thought of that time change in between parts 1 and 2 as particularly doing that, but I kind of don't really know what Anne meant there. I'm very, very happy for her to have said it. But I sort of, yeah, and in fact, I haven't even looked at that for a while, so I will have a look and see. I think it's the kind of surprise element that happens there. And that there is no explaining, and it's presented as just completely normal. There's no, now you might think that I didn't want to be here, when in fact something big happened, and now it's just like, It's a jump cut, I suppose. You know, it would be in film where you're living one life. The person who in film I've been really interested in lately doing this is a director called Celine Sciamma, who you might have seen or heard of her film Portrait of a Lady on Fire. She has this incredible BAFTA screenwriting lecture that is online. And I was turned onto this by the wonderful writer Courtney Collins, who has a new book coming out, I think, this year. But anyway, Courtney said, you should listen to this. It's amazing. And I highly recommend it for anyone wanting to write anything. And she has this brilliant description of how she works, which is she said, I just have a list of desires. And in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, she said, my desires were, I wanted an image of a young woman running full pelt towards a cliff. That was one image. Another one was a woman's dress on fire. That was another image. Another, like these completely unrelated things. And another one was an abortion scene, and then a painting of an abortion scene. Okay, these weird things. So then she has that in this list of desires, and then she has a list of needs, and those are the things that will allow the desires to happen. So she'll have, okay, I need 2 young women, so one of them's got to come into the room, and you know, so all these kind of more logistical things. But I'm sort of rambling about this, just go and listen to it. But there's
it's brilliant bit
where she said, by the end of the film, I have to have moved all the things in the need column into the desire column, so that everything that she sort of thinks, well, I have to do that because logic's saying, by the time the film's done, I want them to be, I want to have filled them with some other kind of energy of my wanting them to be there. Anyway, I just thought it was so thrilling.
Wow, that's incredible.
But, yeah, it's really incredible. Go look it up.
And yeah, we'll look it up and pop it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's really great. But one of the things she does in that film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, is have these complete gaps between, so there are these two young women, they seem to be starting to be attracted to one another, but there's a big power differential. And then in the very next scene, they're kissing on the beach, you know, so there's no development or explanation of how this has come about. It just comes. And she just goes, you just put it together. Like, who cares? I'm not interested in, you know, all the kind of mechanics of how this could possibly happen. She just has it happen. And it's so exhilarating to, when you can write like that, you know, you don't have to dick around with all the boring stuff about, oh, but how do they get there? And what if the, you know, but what if that train didn't go? All that kind of logistical stuff. You can just leave it out.
I just watched that film, Past Lives, the Korean film.
Oh, I haven't seen it, but I really want to see it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's no spoilers, but there are these time jumps that do exactly that.
Mm.
No explanation, and it's perfect.
And there's something very satisfying as the viewer about that. What is it? I don't know why it's so.
I think it's nice to be trusted. It's nice to be trusted as a viewer / reader that I'm trusted to put in, to fill in the gaps myself.
Mm.
It's one of the things.
To just go with you. You'd go with
go with me on
the creator of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that there's a reason for this. Well, I think at the 2/3 mark, you do another little jump. And I think the beauty of it is doing a summary like this creatively with beautiful writing. You say, a deep chill in the air this morning, the first frost right on time. Beautiful, just passing of time in those 10 words.
Thank you. Excellent.
Speaking of sentences, I did the brilliant workshop that you and Tegan Bennett Daylight ran during lockdown called The Live Sentence. Thank you. One of the things that got a lot of writers through, where you talked about the 5 overarching principles of good sentences. And so they were clarity, energy, authority, musicality, and flair. They were the 5 overarching, and then there were sort of these subsets of that. And I mean, we could spend all day talking about how each of these plays out in Stoneyard Devotional, and frankly, I'd love that, and we should probably sell that to a festival, Charlotte. But I'd love to touch on just a couple of those principles, because I think it will be really helpful to writers. Thinking about your desire to really strip this novel back, I guess the concept of clarity and the subset of that that you call economy was important for this novel. The first paragraph is a perfect example of that, and we've partly read that. Arrive finally at about 3. The place has the feel of a 1970s health resort or eco-commune, but is not welcoming. Signs on fences or stuck on little posts by driveways. No entry, no parking, a place of industry, not recreation. I park in a nondescript spot near a fence and sit in a quiet car.
So with this voice that I wanted that was very stripped back, the sentences really have to be quite economical. I think later on, especially that early part, it's a bit more clipped and sort of choppy. And I'm sort of hoping that that's a reflection of her energy when she's there. So she arrives, she isn't in this terribly serene, I mean, she's in a state of real crisis actually when she arrives. It's a more jumpy kind of tone in that early stage of the book. And even though she's kind of exhausted and she lies down on the floor and sleeps and stuff, but when, after a while, she gets a bit bored and she goes down and checks out what they're doing in the church and in the shop with all the hideous candles and whatever. And then I think later on that rhythm in the next part of the book is slower and kind of more orderly. Look, I feel a bit fraudulent talking about sentences in this way, because that was great doing that workshop, which was when we did it, we just pulled a whole bunch of sentences out of other people's work.
Yeah.
We weren't talking about our own, because I don't think I would be able to talk about my own sentences in a useful teaching way, because they just come out of instinct. Mm-hmm. But I guess I do feel strongly that I don't want anything unnecessary in my sentences anymore at any time. But then there are other kinds of books that, so in Emily Bitto's book, Wild Abandon, you know, well, the title already says it, you know, it's a very lush, there's extravagance in the sentences. There's a lot in the language. And that was a very deliberate choice on her part. So I'm not saying the only good sentence is one that's very stripped back at all, but it's just what you kind of want to do as a writer.
Yeah, and what suits the narrative at that point of time. So that suits because she's coming from the big city. She's coming from a stressful job. She's coming from a marriage that's, you know, her husband's overseas. It's all happening. So she's just like very businesslike.
And it's kind of in a denuded state internally, spiritually, however you want to, psychologically. So there's, she has very little to give. And so that's sort of part of what those sentences are, I guess.
It might also be, you know, how people are always saying to reduce anxiety, keep a journal, you know, and she's like, oh, I've been told that to reduce my stress, I need to keep a bloody journal. And so I'm just getting these sentences down.
Whereas
in the second part of the book, she's much more contemplative and relaxed and leading a much slower life.
Yeah. I like the point about flair because it reminds me that even in language that's very simple, you can still find a surprising word. I mean, I'm not saying that I've done it really in that book, but I want to do it.
You have, Charlotte. I'm going to be, you're very modest. I will be the modest mirror to your modesty here and tell you that you have done it many, many times throughout the novel.
Well, thank you. I've just reread Carol Shield's book, Unless. That is just such a brilliant, brilliant novel. I highly recommend it. It's really old now. It's probably 30 years old, but it's really brilliant. And her sophistication with language was so kind of, it was such a galvanizing thing to go, oh, yes, you can do this. You know, one could do that if they're as good as Carol Shields, where, you know, a kind of simple sentence can be really elevated by just one surprising word choice that might be very particular about, you know, describing something or just changes the rhythm of the sentence in an interesting way. For me, sentences are so often about rhythm. And my only kind of guiding principle is whether it sounds right rhythmically. And it's not that it's got to be a beautiful cadence all the time, but mostly with the rhythm, it's not about having a pleasing rhythm all the time, but it's having some kind of rhythm that is then interrupted by another kind of rhythm, you know. So there's sort of that creates movement and energy in the language that can help create movement and energy in the story, especially when you don't have a lot of movement and energy in the story. The language is even more important in doing that work for you.
When you and Tegan were talking about that, it came under that umbrella of energy and the subset of syntax and the arrangement of words. And I took a note at the time where you said that syntax or that arrangement of words is as important as plot, character and setting. And it goes to that rhythm that you were talking about, a section that I thought really demonstrated that. When I tamped down the little chicken's grave with my own black boot, I thought of those babies and those poor girls, and the savagery of the Catholic Church came flooding in once again. Yet here I am, wrestle, wrestle. You could have said, and yet here I am, wrestling with my conflicting emotions about the church and the fact that I'm living in a monastery. And
yes, and that's really fun to do that. You know, it's so kind of, you don't need to do much to convey, wrestle, wrestle, here I am.
Just a beautiful example of it. And also that arrangement of words. You've got this long sentence followed by these short ones. Yet here I am, full stop, wrestle, so. Loved it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And there's that musicality as well. That's one of the other concepts that you and Tegan spoke about, and you were just touching on then as well, how a sentence sounds. Is reading aloud?
I do read, I always, usually at around copy editing stage, I'll read the whole thing aloud beginning to end. But also as I'm writing it, I probably now don't do it so much as I'm writing because I do feel that I hear it very strongly in my head. But certainly before I show a draft to anybody, I would really make sure that I feel the rhythm is right. And the only way to really get that is to read it aloud. So I'd read one bit. So that opening that we talked about, I arrive at about three. Like what's the rhythmic change and how does that sound to me is as important as what is being said.
Even just adding that word, arrive finally at about three.
I do find it really satisfying to see how much can be done with one word, like finally, okay, there's, I remember reading, I think, I'm pretty sure I mentioned it in that workshop actually, Catherine Mansfield's story, The Garden Party.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure the opening of that is something like, and after all, it didn't rain, so blah, blah, blah. I love that sense of the beginning of a story where, hang on, something's already been happening before I got here as a reader. That is very energetic to go, it's like a train's leaving the station and you just have to run and jump on because it's going without you if you don't keep up. So I love that. I loved when I first read that story a long time ago. I was like, that's genius to say, after all, everything was fine. Yeah, and there's a whole story that's already happened without you.
Yeah.
There's been some anxiety about the weather, why there's something's about to happen that needs the weather to be nice. So, oh, there's arrangements that are being made, blah, blah, none of it is mentioned. It just comes in that, and after all, the weather was good.
Charlotte, you've been so generous with your time today, coming off the back of Newcastle Writers Festival, Sorrento Writers Festivals, and I'm sure many, many other events have been in your diary. Thank you so much for coming on. We've really burrowed into the writing, but you've spoken on other podcasts about the themes and questions and ideas in this novel on other podcasts. So I really urge the listeners to go and have a listen to Charlotte's interviews on The Garret with Astrid Edwards and read this with Michael Williams, because they were both fascinating interviews that dove. Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, they were really good. I've been very lucky.
Now, before we go, upcoming festivals, where can the people find you?
Yeah, so next week, Melbourne Writers Festival, followed fairly closely by Sydney Writers Festival, then Brisbane later in the year. There are some others. I think that people like to wait until they announce their lineups and stuff, so I won't talk about it. But really, pretty much anywhere that has a festival, I am there yammering my head off this year.
Yes, and I know you've spoken about awards and your feelings about them, but good luck with both of those shortlistings.
Thank
Charlotte,
you.
It has been such a delight to speak to you. I'm so grateful on behalf of all the writers out there. Thank you for sharing your wisdom today.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. It's been really lovely. And this has been a great chat. I could have gone on. So thank you very much for having me.
There you go, the fabulous Charlotte Wood. I can imagine all of you furiously scribbling in your notebooks during that chat. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to all of those references Charlotte mentioned, as well as her upcoming festival appearances. You can find Charlotte's website at charlottewood.com.au. She's also on Facebook and Instagram. And you can buy a copy of Stoneyard Devotional wherever you buy your books. There's also a link for that in the show notes. Next up on the podcast, another highly experienced novelist, the wonderful Burr Carroll, or BM Carroll, as some of you might know her. Burr has just published her 12th novel, One of Us is Missing, and we're going to be diving into her writing process for that novel. Let me tell you what it's about. Rachel and Rory Sullivan decide to celebrate making it through a difficult year by taking their teenagers, Emmett and Bridie, to their first stadium concert. By the end of the night, one of the four has vanished without a trace. As the police investigation intensifies, suspicion is cast on the remaining family members. Everyone has been deceiving one another, but who is to blame for what went wrong? The passing of each hour amplifies their terror that life will never be the same again. One of Us is Missing is a dark domestic thriller about the dangers lurking right in plain sight. Now, I'm about to dive into this novel just as soon as I can wrestle it out of my husband's hands. He loves a good crimey, suspensey novel, and he inhaled Burr's last book, The Other Side of Her, so I might have to wait a week or so till I get my hands on it. But you can get your hands on it because it came out yesterday, the 30th of April, and it's everywhere. So grab a copy, have a read, and then send in your writing questions for Burr. You can send me a question in a DM on Instagram or Facebook, or there's a form on the website at writersbookclubpodcast.com that you can fill in. As you know, I love asking the author your questions, and I know they do too. And don't forget, everyone who asks a question gets a shout out on the podcast and a link to you in the show notes. So get those questions over to me by about the 20th of May so I can ask Burr in the interview. As always, I'm giving away a copy of this month's book, One of Us is Missing by BM Carroll, with thanks to Affirm Press. All the details for the giveaway are over on Instagram and Facebook. Now, just a reminder for all of you writers who either don't have a website yet, or you have a website but you don't really love it, perhaps, or it's not really working for you, I'm building a course for you called Build an Author Website. It'll be going live later this month. And in it, I will take you step by step through the whole process of building a beautiful, functional new website in Squarespace. I'll help you select the right domain, what to put on your homepage, your book pages, your about page, your blog if you want one, events page, and all your media. We'll set up an online store if you're selling your own books or selling services like editing or mentoring. We'll get your mailing list all set up and connect your socials and also get your SEO sorted. I've created a couple of website templates that are ready to go for you to customize as well, along with some social media templates and 30 days of social media prompts. Basically, I'm aiming to pack in as much value as possible for you so that you can create an author website and platform that you're really proud to show off. So if you'd like to be notified when the course enrollment goes live and get access to an early bird special, head over to freshwebdesign.com.au/course and pop your name on the list. This doesn't commit you to anything. It just means that you'll get early access to the special intro prize. I'm really excited about getting this course to you because I know how many of you have been feeling really stuck when it comes to your author website. You know, not wanting to spend thousands of dollars, but needing a really slick, professional looking site. So jump on the list if you are interested in that. Okay, that's it for this month. I'm recording on the beautiful unceded lands of the Garigal people of the Eora Nation, where I'm lucky enough to live and work. I'll catch you next month. Until then, happy writing.